Hello listeners, today is another day of Behind Wrinkles, where Graham Priest chats with some of the seniors in the community about what they've done in their life, what they're doing in their life, and what they hope to do in the future. Now, older people don't get old instantly. They've had a life before they got old, and you're not just some boring old person that's holding up a queue when you're fiddling for a credit card. Now, today's guest is Richard Cathy, who is currently chairman of the Coastlands Group and has been a long-term resident of the coast and lawyer. Richard, where did it all start for you? Where were you born?
I was born in Masterton, actually, when my father was working up there and during the war. He was running an essential industry there and... a year or so later, we moved to Eastbourne, Wellington, and that's really where I spent the rest of my youth.
Eastbourne. You're a wartime baby like me. How did that affect you growing up?
Well, I think it affected us in many ways. It was the end of sort of the Victorian era, but our parents were brought up by Victorian people, and thrift was very much the order of the day. You didn't waste money buying coffees and things like that, if they were available even. I suppose our generation did learn what perhaps some of the more recent generations haven't learned, which is about restraining your spending on things that were necessary only. They weren't the easiest of times, but you could say the 50s and 60s in New Zealand were pretty good times for young people to grow up, much less concern about self and mental health. You just got on with life. But it's much more complex now, I think.
Indeed. So how did it affect your family?
You mean the war?
Yeah.
Well, of course, I had uncles serving overseas. My godfather was a prisoner of war when I was christened. The war affected New Zealanders, New Zealand families, in many ways. They were pretty tough times. There wasn't a lot of money being made. We weren't a wealthy family at all. We had a comfortable existence.
Yes, I can distinctly remember after the war, one of the first things that I remember having, which I'd never ever had before, was peanut butter. And also pencils became covered in paint.
Yes.
And you could write on a piece of paper without the ink going all blotchy like blotting paper.
Yes.
So, and also when I was in the at college, I had to be a member of the cadets, and we had to wear ghastly things that we called sandpaper suits, which were supplied by the army. And I might say they were exceedingly ill-fitting and very uncomfortable. So, whereabouts were you educated?
I was at Muirutai School in Eastbourne. And then went to Wellington College and had 5 years there and subsequently did my law degree at Victoria University. So I lived in Eastbourne all that time and travelled by bus into town every day and back.
And, of course, there's a great rivalry between your college and my college, Nelson, in the quadrangular annual football, which we always managed to win, of course. So what made you decide to become a lawyer?
Well, I always had ideas right through my teens that that's what I want to do. I was quite good at English, and it was my strong point, I suppose. And I liked debating, and I was really into theatre. I did quite a lot of acting when I was at college. And all those sort of tended to point me in that direction.
So what happened after university?
After university, I did what everyone did, and or nearly everyone, and did my OE.
And where was that?
In the UK. And I arrived in London in 67, and I taught for a while at a secondary modern school in Dagenham in the east of London.
That's where they made Ford motor cars.
That's right, yeah. It was a fairly depressed area, and you can imagine the kids were pretty rough.
And what was the experience like of teaching?
It was difficult, quite traumatic. I enjoyed it, but really I wasn't trained to be a teacher. I was teaching English and drama, of all things. Having just graduated in law, I was really probably not much use to the kids, but it was fun. It only lasted a few months, and eventually I got a job as in a law office in the centre of London.
And how long did you spend there?
I was in the law office for 2 years, and I got married there in London to a girl from Northern Ireland that I met on the ship going over. And, 2 years in litigation in London was a quite good experience for me. Had some interesting cases, and I learnt a lot.
Right, and what happened when you came back?
Well, I joined a firm called Morrison Taylor & Co. in Wellington, and one of the senior partners was a fellow called Neville Simpson, who was one of the founding directors of Coast and Shopping Town. He was a specialist in Maori land law and had helped Ray Spackman sort out the issues of Maori land that were involved when they acquired the land right at the start.
So I can actually remember him quite well.
So he became my partner, and when he retired, he asked me if I would take over as a director. This was in the early 70s.
That was a very exciting period in Coastland's life.
It was, and you were very much part of it, weren't you?
Yes, we were. The partnership that we had with Dean McIntosh and Sandy Gunn were initial owners of the pharmacy there. And it was a very exciting period. I actually ran the Paraparaumu Beach store for a couple of years until there was a change in one of the partners left. So I moved then to Coastlands, and it was a real buzzy, very happy place.
And you were a very good businessman too, Graham. You ran that shop, the pharmacy, brilliantly, I thought.
Well, it was a challenge, and we ended up being within probably the top half dozen of turnover for pharmacies at that time in New Zealand. Of course, as other centres grew much larger, we kind of lost that, but we still remained the largest customer for our New Zealand pharmacy cooperative wholesaler, and we remained so until they sold out. So it's an intensely interesting period.
And Dan McIntosh was a lovely chap.
Well,
he was great fun. He was on the board, as you know.
Dan was one of the people that had a tremendous effect on my growing up as a businessman rather than as a pharmacist. He had a peculiar motto. The harder he worked, the luckier he got, which really pretty well sums up Dan. He's not that well known apart from being in the pharmacy or as a fisherman. but he had, he was what you call a decent man. Mm. And his principles in business was very sound. And he did make the comment to me when I first went with him. He said, there's nobody that I can walk along the street and not look in the eye. And I've never forgot that, which is pretty fair summation of what he was like.
He was. He was a very fine man.
Mm. Yeah. So you took over as a director from Neville. What made you want to do that?
Well, being a commercial lawyer in Wellington was a fairly constrained in some senses. But to get involved in the retail industry and firsthand to managing a shopping town as big as that, helping to manage it, was a wonderful new experience to me. And I enjoyed every meeting that I went to in those early days. And that's continued. It's always a lot of fun. It's interesting. The retail industry takes a lot of learning, and there are no simple answers with it. I'm happy to say I've been involved, it's been quite successful. The Coast and Shopping Town has.
Race Backman was also a very interesting character. He was almost like a bee with a bum full of honey because he never sat still. Yeah. He was our company accountant for many years. And he was extremely perceptive and had a very sharp mind, but he was also very forward-thinking. The chairman of our cooperative wholesaler for pharmacy was a similar sort of person, and somebody described him as being somebody that's identified the dry ground when everybody else is up to their ass in alligators.
Yes, well, he was a great enthusiast and always wanted to... Coast and Shopping Town wouldn't exist but for Ray. It was his concept and he drove it. And of course, that wasn't the only thing he was interested in. You remember the Lion Park, he was right behind that.
Yeah, best not to talk about that one.
Yes. So he had his failures, but he also had his successes. And of course, Bruce and Neville Simpson and Den were good restraining influences on him, I think, in those early days.
Probably just as well.
Yeah.
But he was a very interesting man, and I liked him a lot. And he certainly helped us a lot.
Mm.
Now, Coastlands has been in existence since 1969, and it seems to have carried on successfully in what really was a pretty small area, whereas others like Wainui, Upper Hutt, Jay Moore, Levin, have all sort of stuttered and fallen by the wayside. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's independent. It hasn't been consumed by a conglomerate. It's still just over 100 shareholders, nearly all of whom are locals, people who are interested in the retail industry and particularly in how the Coast and Shopping Town fares. They're great supporters. They're right behind the charitable work that we do, the philanthropic things. Well, I've never had any shareholder question any of those commitments that we've made over the years.
The board has made some extremely large donations, for want of a better word, to a lot of organisations over the years. And strangely, it doesn't seem to have got the kudos that it's due. I mean, you forked out, $500,000 for the Performing Arts Centre. There was 750 odd thousand for the swimming pool. There's half a million odd for the all-weather turf. And it goes on and on and on.
O'Hara Gallery is the latest, of course.
And that money could easily have gone in the shareholders' pockets.
It could. And there are plenty of businesses, some of them large, who've taken a lot out of the community in Kapiti over the years, who haven't done the same. Plenty have, but it's true that it probably we haven't had the kudos, and that's probably because we've been a bit reticent to crow about it. But perhaps we should make it better known what we have been doing in that area. It's probably not in our nature to do that. We think it speaks for itself, and it'll be recognised in due course. And I think, you know, the current mayor has said to me a number of times, you know, how much the council appreciates the support that we give some of these community projects.
That may well be, but there hasn't always been a very happy relationship with some of the people within council. Why is that?
Oh, I think that's natural. We're, you know, we're an expanding neighbour of theirs, wanting to see an orderly development of retail in the district rather than a piecemeal, sporadic development in various parts. We don't think it's good for Kapiti to have too much retail sprawl. The centre of Kapiti is coastlands, and it should remain so. And that's the council's professed intention over the years, but sometimes you wonder whether they, with some of their planning decisions, you know, whether they really are committed to that. And that's when we've had some issues with them.
As well as coastlands, you've had a lot of other interests. I believe that you're also a fairly accomplished pianist, is that correct?
I don't know who told you that, but I wouldn't. I don't think anyone who hears me these days would. My fingers are getting a little bit not as good as they were. But yes, I play the piano. I've got a nice Yamaha Baby Grand that I spend quite a bit of time on.
Good news. Mm. All right. You've also had a very long enduring relationship with various arts. At one time, you were interested in the Hannah Playhouse, or Downstage, as it's usually called. What was behind that?
Well, I guess at Wellington College, one of the masters was Richard Campion, Jane Campion's father, a famous director, and he and his wife formed the original New Zealand Players. And he was teaching at Wellington College, and I got involved in a few of the drama projects there and got interested in acting and did some acting and later did some downstage productions. We did their first late night production at the old boating club building, you remember, on the waterfront.
Indeed.
And that was their first, and Roger Hall and Steve Whitehouse, there were three of us, put on this late night review, which went for a month or two. When I came back from England, I think it might have been Bill Sheet suggested that I might get on the board. And I think I became the company secretary initially, and then later became a director, and eventually ended up, I was chairman in my early 40s for about 8 years of Downstage Theatre Company. And that was at a time when it was really rollicking along, and we had two vans on the road with theatre and schools programs. We had permanent staff of about 30. I eventually pulled out of that and let someone else take over. But I then went on the Hannah Playhouse board. I'd been involved with their fundraising efforts to build the new playhouse. And then I stayed on the Hannah Playhouse board. I was its chair for a while until about 3 years ago.
So it's quite interesting to see what happened at Downstage. My wife and I were very regular attenders, and it seemed to me that the people running the play section or the entertainment seemed to have lost touch with a lot of the audience. And there was a lot of what one might almost term long-haired intellectual plays that seemed totally weird to us, and we gave up going. What was the reason for that?
Well, there was a policy that was always followed, that the artistic director had the license to select the plays. The artistic director would usually discuss it with the board in advance, what the program would be, but the board was always reluctant to interfere. So to some extent you had the artists sort of controlling the program, which of course had its weaknesses, and artistic directors would stay for, say, 5 years and move on, and you'd have someone else who had who wanted to put on certain productions. One of the biggest issues, of course, was that there was so much money going into Wellington Theatre, with the pressure from the Auckland theatres on Creative New Zealand, the Arts Council, to apply some of that excess that went to Wellington up to Auckland, that someone had to pay for it. And I think the Arts Council, I was on the Arts Council at an earlier stage, but I think they probably felt that Downstage was the one that was going to go. And unfortunately, because it was such a wonderful theatre, Downstage collapsed, of course, when the funding was withdrawn.
It's a shame, because it was a brilliant idea, and there's no reason why it couldn't have carried on, really, because you look at the success of Circa, and their policy seems to be that they've got an very small theatre attached where all the experimental stuff was run, and the main one is popular theatre that puts bums on seats and money through the door.
Yes,
and that seems to be quite successful.
And they've been wonderfully successful, and can't question that. They have, for many, many years, of course, survived at the expense of the practitioners who work in the place, because they only take out of it what they can get from box office. Whereas at Downstage, we were paying union rates to everyone who worked there, regardless of the success of the productions. Things are slightly different now, but Circa. But I think they guarantee certain minimum incomes to their actors now, but I'm not sure of the detail. But in those days, they didn't. And so if you had a flop at Circa, you could come away with virtually nothing.
They haven't had too many flops.
No, they haven't. And I think their program has been excellent. There's no question that Downstage did lose a lot of its audience, and I think we can spend time debating that, why it happened. It was certainly due in some significant measure due to programming.
Well, I recall what finally finished us was the first act of a play that we went to. There was a young woman standing on the stage. She shoved her head in a bucket of water, held it there for a period, pulled her head out, shook her head, and then stuffed it back in the bucket. And I just couldn't relate to that style of entertainment. Didn't seem sensible to pay money to see it. And I have a feeling that there are a number of other people that felt the same.
It was challenging theatre, and Downstage went through various periods when it really did set out to challenge.
Mm.
And we were not ready at that time for it. Something like Bats now a theatre in Wellington, which is doing well, does challenge you, and people love going to challenging performances. So times are changing.
But the way Bats is run, it's much lower overhead. Now, what's the future of the Hannah Playhouse?
Well, I understand, although it hasn't been announced yet, that the City Council is going to be more involved in making it available as a venue. And it's still owned by the Hannah Playhouse Trust.
Well, it's a magnificent building.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's purpose-built, and it fulfills its requirement.
Mm. So hopefully there's a good future for it. At the, over the last few years, it has been used. The National Children's Theatre, for example, has been using it for quite a few years, which is based in Wellington. And various theatre groups have been using it from time to time.
Well, it's good to see that it's got some use, and hopefully that will grow.
Mm.
So what's the future for you? What do you see as happening in the next few years for Richard Cathy?
Well, it depends on the Lord, of course, just what happens. But I'm still very involved in the arts. For many years, I've been on the management committee and the was a trust which ran the Catherine Mansfield Monton Fellowship for Writers. And every year we send a fellow to Monton in the south of France near Nice for around 6 months, where they can study and write in a room which is set aside for that, and they are paid enough to meet their travel expenses and accommodation while they're there. And I've been involved in a few other things. Recently I retired from the New Zealand Players Theatre Trust, which when New Zealand Players folded, they had a workshop in Adelaide Road in Newtown, and the proceeds of sale of that were held in trust for many years. And I helped to establish a trust or reinvigorate the original trust, and so we were making grants to theatre in Wellington from that, and that's still happening. So I've still got plenty to do. I'm still struggling around the Waikanae golf course a few times a week if I'm lucky. Getting worse, but still enjoying it. And so hopefully my wife's, as I think I mentioned, from Northern Ireland, her family are there, and we like to get over there to see her two sisters and brother when we can. So
life's pretty interesting.
Mm.
Now, at some stage, you have been rewarded by government with an award. What was that?
Well, I did receive the Order of Merit for services to the arts a few years back.
Something to be pretty proud of.
Well, yes, it was a surprise, nice surprise. Okay. One of the biggest jobs that I had in the arts was the formation of the Arts Foundation of New Zealand. And I guess I probably got awarded the Order of Merit for that. It was an initiative of the Creative New Zealand. They came to me, Brian Stevenson and Sir Ronald Scott, asking if I could help them set up a philanthropic organisation to bring private money into the arts. And now it's distributed millions to artists all around the country. So it's extremely successful.
I'd suggest that it was an award well deserved. This has been another session of Behind the Wrinkles with Graham Priest. Today's guest was Richard Cathy, long-time lawyer, chairman of the Coastlands Group, and generally interested in the arts. Thank you for listening. Doobie, 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 doobie.
This program is made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.